Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed. We can work it out. And it feels like the economy, or maybe the Fed monetary policy, kind of working its way out on the U.S. economy. Because we definitely, as we just talked about with Katie and Romaine, definitely seeing things maybe slowing down. Right, Tim?
Let's talk about what we saw this morning. Non-farm payrolls, you know the numbers by now, increasing to 150,000 last month. It was less than expected. And then they got the revision for last month, Carol, which is an important one.
Agreed.
Revised down to 297,000. The unemployment rate climbing to 3.9%. Monthly wage growth slowing. If you're Jay Powell, if you're the Federal Reserve, you're saying everything is kind of moving in the direction that I want it to.
He's high-fiving everybody on the FOMC.
It's kind of weird because the unemployment rate is going up and fewer people got jobs than expected.
Right.
So,
we talk about bad news, good news for the markets. So let's get to it, because it does look like a cooling of the U.S. labor market. However, it is a month's report. Our Steve Matthew writing about it, and he says, though, what looks like a cooling U.S. job market gives the Fed a little bit of room to keep interest rates maybe on hold in December, which would be the last meeting of the year, reinforcing market views that the U.S. Central Bank is done with the most aggressive hiking campaign in four decades. It's been quite a ride in the last year. Steve is with us now. He is Bloomberg News economics reporter. He's on Zoom out there in our Atlanta bureau, where Mike is. Mike McKee is getting ready to talk to the Atlanta Fed president. Also with us is our former colleague, who is now the senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, Yelena Shiletyeva. She's on Zoom in New York City. But Yelena, I kind of want to start with you. Today's U.S. jobs and services data, is that it? Can we say the Fed 100% done raising rates?
I think so. This is the kind of the data that will make Fed comfortable to be patient at the upcoming meeting and beyond. At the same time, it's not falling off a cliff, so that should provide them some comfort to stay on hold for quite some time and wait until inflation slows down. So I think that is kind of a Goldilocks scenario for the Fed. In their expectations for a soft landing scenario.
Wait,
this is the type of the report that they would like.
So done, and the next move is going to be a cut in your view, or is it done, and we'll wait a little bit and just see? Or you think done?
I think at the press conference, I think Powell was trying to persuade the markets that they are done without saying it, of course, and keeping the tightening bias in place, but if you read between the lines, that's what he was trying to say, I think.
Steve Matthews, come on in here. Do you agree with Yelena that this is the kind of data that will make the Fed comfortable keeping rates steady for quite a while, and it could be the last rate hike, at least in this cycle?
Absolutely agree. I mean, this is, if the Fed was making up numbers and trying to figure out what would be good numbers for the kind of outcome that they're looking for, they would come to exactly this kind of thing. I mean, they want to see unemployment, the unemployment rate just very slightly, gradually up. They believe 4% unemployment is full employment. So, and they believe that the labor market has been overheating, and they want to see a slight cooling off, but nothing dramatic. And this is a slight cooling off, but not dramatic. And you're seeing wage gains that are coming down a little bit. So the pressure is coming off the labor market. Powell said on Wednesday he wanted to see rebalancing. You know, there's a lot of evidence in here that you're seeing that rebalancing. So, you know, we're having Rafael Bostic into our office in a few minutes. And, you know, in some ways he could be doing a victory dance today, because it's like he's been saying since the first half of the year, stop, you know, we've done enough. And let's go on an extended pause. And we, you know, the monetary policy works with a lag. And that seems to be, you know, the outcome that we're seeing. So while other Fed officials are very likely to say, you know, don't rule out additional cuts, we still have the possibility that we're going to go higher. It certainly seems like, you know, absent there being some really bad surprise on inflation, they're likely done.
When you said don't rule out, you meant further increases, right? Not cuts.
Exactly. Okay, exactly. So they're not looking at cuts. And in fact, you know, I think, you know, until you get into the middle of part of next year, they are pretty committed to staying on hold and not moving lower until you get to inflation either at 2% or very close, moving in that direction.
Right. We did see Fed swaps price the first rate cut by June meeting versus July prior. So a little bit of a move up in terms of how traders are seeing it. So, Yelena, are you guys starting to put out research that says, okay, we're going to get a rate cut come June, or are you going to wait on that one?
Well, we do have that in our baseline projection. So we have the first rate cut in June, and then a 1 percentage point of cuts in the remainder of next year.
Wow.
I just wanted to add a little bit to what Steve was saying in terms of Chair Powell mentioning the supply side story and how the labor market is coming back into balance. I think while this report was an okay report for the Fed, it does throw some cold water on that argument about, you know, the supply side of the economy coming back. It does show some vulnerabilities on the demand side. You see a significant slowing in retail, transportation, and this is going into the holiday season. So things are slowing, hiring is slowing in this important part of the economy. Leisure and hospitality spike during the summer months was indeed temporary, and that is slowing down. We see diffusion index declining to a cyclical low. That tells you that the breadth of job hiring is also shrinking. So I would be cautious. This kind of number is a good number, but that shows some vulnerabilities in the economy going into the year end.
Okay, so it's kind of, Carol, stands in contrast to what we heard from Chrissy Taylor over at Enterprise last week in terms of...
She's pretty upbeat, right?
She was pretty upbeat, not just on the consumer, but also on the signs that she's getting from Enterprise's trucking leasing business.
Right.
And the tracking that they do.
Which is kind of peculiar. Yeah.
It was kind of peculiar. Steve, Matthews, come on back in here and give us an idea of what could actually prompt the Fed to cut rates next year. Like, what are the economic signals that you're looking for a rate hike in the middle of the year?
I think there's a view.
I mean, a rate cut, excuse me.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a view at the Fed that, you know, as inflation comes down, real interest rates widen. I mean, essentially, you know, if inflation moves down to 2% and you have the Fed funds rate at 5.5%, that's 3.5% gap. And so as inflation comes down, you're seeing monetary policy tightening. So, really, I think the figures that are most important in terms of when they're going to cut is when inflation comes down, because they at some point they're not going to want to see additional monetary policy tightening, and they view, you know, real rates as an important signal.
Yeah, and I'm curious about, you know, just watching some of those sentiment numbers that we will get next week too, because, you know, how people feel about their situation. And we've been certainly doing surveys here at Bloomberg of individuals. What they're concerned about is, yeah, they might be working, but they're paying a heck of a lot for everything, or they're paying more for their car, you know, loan or lease, if you will, loan, I guess, in particular, or they're paying more on their mortgage, or they can't even get into a mortgage. All right. So, Yelena, what is the number one thing on your radar, let's say, for the next week or so?
We'll be watching the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey coming out on Monday. The Fed had the data at their meeting this week, and things are not easing. So, you know, lending conditions are tightening, and all of the things that you mentioned, Carol, you know, consumers looking at car loans, buying a car at a higher interest rate, those things will be reflected in that survey. And, you know, further deterioration in lending standards, I think, is relevant to what the Fed is going to do next.
Same question to you, Steve. What's you've got, you know, Rafael Bostic coming up. I don't know if that's top of mind right now in terms of what, but tell me what's kind of top of mind for you.
Bostic is definitely top of mind for me since he's now in the office. And
what would you ask him? Just 30 seconds. What would you, what would be?
Well, the same question you would ask, which is, you know, what's going to cause cuts now that it seems like that we may have peaked. But I think besides the SLU survey, which I agree entirely is going to be interesting on Monday, there's a ton of Fed speak, and it's like how they interpret the data, how they interpret what's happening with financial markets, and you know, there was financial market tightening in advance of the meeting. Now we're seeing some loosening.
Right.
I mean, yields are down, and it's like, you know, how do they view that? You have Chris Waller, you have some others who are speaking,
right.
Bostic and Barkin next week. So there'll be plenty to listen to.
Yeah, we'll see if there's one narrative or multiple. Bloomberg News economics reporter, of course, joining us there in Atlanta, and then Yelena Shalaitcheva. Thank you so much.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, as we promised, we have got a few perspectives on the U.S. labor market. We heard from Steve Matthews at Bloomberg News and Yelena Shalaitcheva over at BNP Paribas. Here's another perspective. We got Julia Pollack, chief economist at ZipRecruiter, joining us from Los Angeles. Just a quick recap for those who haven't been following all day. The data series showed job growth slowing by more than expected, Carol, and the unemployment rate rising to an almost two-year high, 3.9%. Monthly wage growth slowed too. Bad news, good news.
Yeah, exactly. And I know you and I both have gotten a peek at Julia's research over at ZipRecruiter, and I feel like it's going to mesh with some of what we got from the government this morning. Julia, good to have you back with us on Business Week. Are you seeing signs that the job market here in the United States is cooling?
We are seeing lots of signs. I mean, all the key indicators in this jobs report point in that direction. The decline in working hours, the slowdown in wage growth, the uptick in the unemployment rate, particularly for younger workers. These all suggest that demand for labor is slackening. I mean, that household survey was very weak this month. That said, you know, the weakness in payrolls may be overstated. We have to keep in mind that the UAW strike was in full swing during the reference week of the survey, and that's since been resolved, or partly resolved. And actually, there were strikes across the economy and in all kinds of industries, with 96,000 people absent from work due to strikes, the highest number since 1997. So if you add all those workers back in, and then maybe take away about 40,000 for the average revision that we've seen so far this year, with 8 out of 9 reports being revised downwards, you know, that brings you to a number that is around 230,000. Still a slowdown. Not terrible, though.
A slowdown, but 230,000 would be significantly higher than the 180,000 that economists surveyed by Bloomberg expected. And maybe they took into account the strikes that were happening. Julia, are you saying that perhaps, and look, I know you're a labor economist, so you're not focused on what's going on in the equity and the bond markets right now, but would you suggest that the celebrations are a little early in terms of a soft landing here?
No, I mean, I think the bulk of the data in both the establishment survey and the household survey came in weak. So in the establishment survey, you have working hours, overtime hours, you have the wage growth numbers. Those are all pretty weak. I mean, wage growth over the last 3 months at an annualized rate has been just 3.2%. Economists think that 3.5% would be consistent with 2% inflation, right? Because workers should get a 2% boost to make them whole for inflation, plus another 1.5% boost a year to account for productivity growth. And productivity growth is looking good at the moment. That figure was over 4%, 4.9% last quarter. So,
which might explain what? That maybe we're all working maybe, I don't know, harder, better, I don't know. And then maybe there isn't that need to hire. But I wonder, what I want to ask you is, Julia, there was such a feeling of labor hoarding. We talked about it a lot. Of coming out of the pandemic, people didn't want to let go of workers because it was so hard to get a worker. Is that kind of going away?
No, it doesn't appear to be. In the latest JOLTS report, layoffs were still very low. And what you see is that we're kind of in a low churn state right now with employers reluctant to lay workers off, worried about how expensive and difficult it will be to replace them, but also quits kind of back to normal, and workers no longer feeling as confident about quitting their jobs, no longer as confident that they'll find better ones. So everyone's sort of sheltering in place, and as a result, hires are low. And the reason that job gains are still so positive is more because the rate at which the water's going out of the bathtub has slowed, not so much that we're bringing in a lot of new people into the labor market.
Do you think employers are back in the driver's seat?
So we just released a report on our new research website, ZipRecruiterResearch.org, about what is going on for new hires and job switchers. And we found that across pretty much every measure of leverage and bargaining power that we track, they have lost considerable power in the last month, I mean, even in the last quarter. The share who got a signing bonus fell to 18% from 28%. The share who got a raise when they switched jobs fell meaningfully. The share who, when they quit their job, got a call from their old employer saying, we need you to stay, we'll match your outside offer, we'll counter, that fell meaningfully. So workers are no longer being fought over as such a hot commodity.
Interesting. So is it where we were pre-pandemic, right before the pandemic, or a little bit weaker? I don't know. What's your read on it? You're talking with companies, you guys are working with companies too. How would you describe it? Give me a couple of adjectives to describe how you think the labor market is right now in the United States.
Sure. So my read on it is that things are a little bit weaker than they were right before the pandemic. Working hours at 34.3 are at the very low end of the range that we typically see in good economic times. Wage growth is a little tepid given how high inflation is. So real wage growth is not so great for workers. There are still lots of opportunities out there, but workers are finding it's taking them a little bit longer, a couple more applications to get offers. And then the offers they get are not quite as attractive as what they grew used to the last 2 years.
What about when it comes to workers saying, you know, I don't want to go into the office 5 days a week. I want to work from home a little bit, maybe not coming on Fridays or Mondays.
Read the room, baby. Read the
room. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday sounds good for sitting in my chair all day. What's the read you get on that at ZipRecruiter?
So about 11% of job postings are still remote. That's up from about 3% before the pandemic. So remote work is here to stay.
How many? And wait, say that percentage
11%.
Again? 11%. 11%? Wow.
Look, it seems low because 60% of job seekers would prefer to get a remote job. And you really have about 60% of all the workers competing over about 10, 11% of the job postings. So there is a big mismatch between demand and supply of remote work opportunities. That said, we did a survey of employers recently, and we did find that more had pulled back on their remote work policies than expanded remote work. But even so, very few had gone back to the 5-day in-office work week. So the 5-day in-office work week is effectively dead. Very few companies are requiring people in the office 5 days a week. Flexibility is the name of the game.
Well, pretty interesting, no doubt about it. Yeah, it's just interesting to see kind of some of the trends that are out there. Because we certainly see more and more people coming back, right? Or CEOs
yeah, I do,
and leaders
but, you know,
insisting on it.
I will tell you that Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays on the subway are very crowded. Thursdays and Fridays, not so much.
I thought about that this morning coming through World
Nobody.
Trade. I'm like, oh, okay,
Nobody, right?
There's no crowd. Yeah. I can kind of walk through it. Really great stuff. And we so appreciate getting time to check in with you. Julia Pollack, take care and have a great weekend. Chief Economist over at ZipRecruiter on Zoom in Los Angeles. I have to say, going through kind of their surveys and stuff to see things starting to tick down in terms of hours worked, wage growth, like really kind of meshing so well and so strongly with the jobs report this morning.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg today, no doubt about it. We got the verdict last night. We're talking about the case of Sam Bankman-Fried, convicted of a massive fraud that led to the collapse of his FTX exchange following a month-long trial that pitted the testimony of the former crypto king against some of his closest friends. It was
that happened fast, Carol.
It did happen fast.
I mean, think about how long Elizabeth Holmes was sort of in limbo before sentencing. And he hasn't been sentenced yet, but...
No, but this, the verdict came down pretty quickly.
Very quickly, yeah. Bankman-Fried, for those just catching up, he was found guilty of 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy after jurors in Manhattan deliberated for fewer than 5 hours on Thursday. Mm-hmm. He faces as many as 20 years in prison on each of the most serious charges. Judge Lewis Kaplan set the sentencing date in late March.
All right, so let's get to our weekly check on the crypto market. Thoughts on the trial, the verdict, the future legal woes to come maybe for others in the industry. With us is Bloomberg News legal reporter Ava Benny Morrison. She's been following SBF's trial in Lower Manhattan throughout. She is on Zoom in New York City. And also with us is Stephen McClurg. He's chief investment officer of the financial services firm Valkyrie Investments, former managing director at Guggenheim Partners, where he was focusing on fixed income and private equity. He is on Zoom from Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Ava, I want to start with you. What a month. I believed you got married in the middle of it too, but is that right?
I did.
Congratulations. I mean, not great timing with what you're covering right now, but I think the wedding is
like,
you know,
I'm going down the aisle. Like I'm going to, but anyway, so quick verdict. It felt like, was it not? Talk to us about your kind of the process and then the verdict coming down so quickly and what ultimately happened.
Very quick verdict, actually. After the jury started their deliberations yesterday afternoon at about 3:15, we were taking bets in the press room of when the jury would come back. And I actually bet that it was going to be last night. I think someone owes me lunch for that. But it was a very quick turnaround. They had a couple of notes early in the evening. The judge had said that they could stay if they wanted to and deliberate until 8 p.m. last night. They decided to. They were going to have dinner, get a car, Uber or a Lyft home. And they submitted a couple of questions, jury notes, asking for highlighters and post-it notes. They also asked for transcripts of certain testimony from institutional investors at FTX. So we thought maybe they might be in for the long haul, but then about 20 minutes to 8 p.m., the 8 p.m. deadline, they came back with another note saying that they'd reached a verdict. It was a little bit frantic in the actual courtroom because people weren't really expecting it at that point. Mm. Everyone was sort of moving around, jostling for a seat, and then all the lawyers, the prosecutors, and of course Sam himself and his parents walked in.
What was Sam's reaction when the judge or the jury, I don't know who read this, we don't have cameras in there, you were in there, what was his reaction when he heard the verdict?
Sam was very still when he was sitting at the bar table between his two lawyers. Usually he's sort of bouncing his knee around and you can see him fidgeting a little bit, but last night he was dead still, almost like a statue. The judge asked him to stand and face the jury. The jury foreperson read out the guilty verdicts one by one, saying guilty 7 times. He kept his eyes down, looking at the floor most of the time. His hands were in front of him, and he was completely unemotional. He looked stunned, almost a little bit shell-shocked
and before sitting down again. His parents, though, were completely distraught. So they were sitting on the bench in front of me in the courtroom comforting one another.
Can only imagine.
It was quite difficult.
Stephen, come on in on the conversation. You know, how do you think this trial might potentially impact the crypto market and the interest of it as an investment or means of transaction? What might be a longer term impact, if any?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Carol and Tim. Mm-hmm. My initial reaction was, you know, we're glad that this is finally behind us, because the FTX situation and all the other related issues has had a really broad negative impact on the industry for about the last 18 months. You know, we weren't immune to the damage either, despite not having any kind of relationship to those companies. And now that we finally have a verdict, I feel like investor confidence in the crypto market will start rising again. You know, we're already seeing confidence coming back to the markets. Usually when there's a fraud, it can affect any market segment. But when justice is served, which was served yesterday, and we'll finally get the, you know, the final verdict later, there's usually a relief, and a relief rally comes with that, and a recognition that the next fraud is going to be harder to pull off and that criminals will get caught.
Bitcoin's actually down a little bit, about 0.8% today. I mean, I know it's one day, but just saying.
Stephen, can you talk a little bit about the damage that you guys experienced as a result of not just this trial, but of the downfall of FTX? You referred to it, but what specifically did you see at Valkyrie?
Yeah, you know, over really the last two calendar years, and it didn't start with FTX. It started with Celsius and Voyager, and a couple of other and BlockFi is another good example. And the pinnacle was really FTX. But we really saw less flows coming in, whether it's through ETFs or whether it's through hedge funds that, you know, we manage each. So we really did see flows start to dry up. And when the FTX trials started coming around earlier this summer, we did begin to see flows coming back to the market. So it really was a case of investor sentiment saying, you know, I don't want to touch that market for a little bit until we understand really what's going on. Markets like certainty. And I think they wanted to have certainty that it wasn't a crypto problem, rather it was a fraud and criminal problem.
So, all right. So, Ava, how are you kind of thinking about the crypto world from a legal perspective? Lionel Laurent, has a Bloomberg Opinion column out, and he says SBF won't be the last crypto mogul behind bars. So there are other cases in litigation out there.
Yeah, do the Bloomberg quiz this week, Carol.
Oh,
that's a nice hint for a question on there. Okay.
That is very true. So are you anticipating that you're going to get ready for some other, you know, cases to be following?
Yes, definitely. In federal court in Manhattan, the prosecution office down here has made a big point of saying, you know, just because this was crypto and it was a new technology, a new market, the fraud is the same. It doesn't matter what the vehicle is that's being used to perpetuate this fraud. So FTX was one of many crypto companies that the prosecution office went after. We're also waiting to see what happens with Alex Mashinsky, who was the founder of Celsius, Do Kwon, who was the founder of Terraform Labs. So it'll be interesting to see, I guess, if you can take any lessons from what happened with FTX. Obviously, there was a lot of evidence in this case, and the prosecution was really blessed with having three insiders from Sam Bankman-Fried's inner circle turning around and agreeing to be cooperating witnesses for them.
So what happens to them, Ava?
They will be sentenced. They've sort of done their bit for the government, and the judge will weigh up just how valuable they were and then determine what their punishment would be. Those executives, just to refresh everyone's memories, were Gary Wong, the co-founder of FTX, Caroline Ellison, who was the CEO of Alameda Research, and Nishad Singh, who was the engineering chief at FTX. They all had cooperation agreements with the government and gave evidence. And they were saying, we're hoping we don't get jail time from this. So we'll have to wait and see.
Stephen, got about a minute left here. What would you like to see in terms of government oversight or rules or greater transparency in the crypto world?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's necessarily an issue with crypto, and I also don't know if there's necessarily, you know, additional investor protections that need to take place here. The bottom line is, sophisticated investors were fooled here. We just happened to be fortunate enough to have a really stubborn and risk focused team when we were engaging with counterparties like Celsius and FTX, and decided not to engage with them because they didn't fulfill our process of due diligence. And I think what happened is, you know, anytime that there's a new market and there's hype around that market and people making money, it does create a bit of FOMO, and people forget their process, people forget their past learnings, whether it was learnings from Enron or learnings right. from Madoff. I mean, I was a credit analyst looking at Greece right. when the Greek debt crisis came about, and avoided it. So we avoided these issues. And I think people just have to remember that you follow a process, you do your due diligence, and you make sure that you mitigate risk.
Stephen McClurg, thank you so much, over at Valkyrie. And of course, our own Ava Benny Morrison covering the trial for us.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, the numbers, Carol, are not pretty. Less than a quarter of the 292.4 million tons of municipal solid waste, read trash, that was generated back in 2018 was recycled. That's according to the latest figures from the U.S. EPA. Actually, it's kind of more than I thought it would be. Mm. Yeah, so that's, you know.
Yeah, 25%.
Yeah.
You thought it would be less.
Thought it'd be less. But there's a long way to go.
Yeah, and our next guest actually thinks we could do a lot better. Keith Harrison is the founder and CEO of the Recycling Partnership. It's an industry-funded nonprofit that advocates for improving recycling infrastructure and accessibility. The Recycling Partnership says that over the last 8 years, it's diverted 770 million pounds of new recyclables from landfills, which has avoided more than 670,000 metric tons of greenhouse gases. And Keith joins us on Zoom from Washington, D.C.
That's legit. That's a lot of... A lot of greenhouse gases that have been avoided. Keith, thanks so much for joining us. Excited to have you with us this afternoon. I love talking about recycling because I think that there are so many.
You're composting now?
I'm composting, got the garbage disposal too. Separating, you know, here in New York, we got to separate everything into, you know, it's not single stream. but one thing that Carol and I were surprised to learn recently is specifically about plastics and to what extent plastics are not actually recyclable in this day and age. So I want to start there, and then we'll get to what's going on with America Recycles Day a little later in the month.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me in today. Glad to talk about this. If you want to go out to dinner afterwards, composting, also a favorite topic.
Okay, that's awesome. Well, we got plenty of time. So talk to us about what's going on with plastics right now, because a lot of people have this misconception that if they recycle it, then it just gets reused and made into something else, which is beautiful.
And if we see that thing on the bottom, that like circular,
just throw it in the recycling bin.
We think, okay, it's going to get recycled.
Who cares about the number in there?
Exactly.
Well, yeah, you know what? There's been a lot of, recycling has been in the news a lot lately, and some of the stories are really depressing. And I want to start with a story of hope that it's not working exactly as we need it to, but we can fix this sucker, and then we'll have something else to talk about on the other side. So when we look at what's really happening with recycling today, we see a huge opportunity for improvement. We see that 7 out of 10 cardboard boxes end up in the trash. That's very similar to 7 out of 10 PET bottles and glass bottles also end up in the trash. Is that fixable? Yes. What happens when we do? Even more carbon savings, as you outlined. So the story on plastics, though, gets a little bit trickier because there are so many types of plastics. One word, many different things. So you really have to understand the strata of opportunity so you can go after the easier to fix ones like yogurt cups and PET bottles, and then build a longer timeline for the stuff that's trickier, like plastic wrap, stuff like that.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about trash here.
You know, Carol talks a lot of trash. That's what happens.
I do that too. Sorry. Guilty as charged. No, but I do wonder about, you know, the impact of landfills and garbage in a year where climate change felt like it was, you know, thrust in front of our face. If you didn't believe it, like you couldn't ignore some of the stuff that was going on, whether it was temperatures or fires or what have you, or, you know, the skies over New York and the New York Metro turning orange. So landfills, just remind everybody about the impact that they have on the environment.
Yes. Landfills are purposely made to keep out air and sun and rain. We purposely cap them. We encapsulate them actually in plastic to keep things from breaking down. Because when they break down without air, light, and rain, it creates methane. That anaerobic state inside of a landfill creates methane. However, well, although the intent is to prevent things from breaking down, they still do. And in fact, landfills are one of the biggest emitters of methane, which is one of our strongest and most potent greenhouse gases.
So we should all be composting, is what you're saying.
There, back to the compost rate. Yeah, actually, food waste is, the EPA just released a really good report about the role of food waste and organics. So banana peels and your yard trimmings, what happens when those land in a landfill. But it's also, you know, things that naturally break down like fiber, paper products and things like that. So we have to be really careful before we casually toss something into a landfill because it is directly connected to the climate.
I don't think people know this. This is the problem.
I was going to say to you, like if you go, like in California, don't you have like multiple cans? Like you have to divide. Yeah,
and it's pretty amazing. I mean, every time I go back to see my parents in California, the can situation changes. And what's happened is the recycling can has gotten huge. The compost bin has gotten huge. The trash can has gotten tiny.
I love that.
There's so...
Tim, that is the future.
It's incredible to see this.
Right. And so what we're trying to work towards is instead of it just being like that in California or in New York City, having really strong recycling programs, but it's a different way, we're trying to build harmonization. And so I get really interested in the role of policy to make it consistent from one place to another, but to also level up that caliber of service so that you can make sure you're composting, you can make sure that you're recycling as many different things as possible. We want old stuff to turn into new stuff so that it never hits that landfill. And the role of policy is a new tool that we're seeing on the US landscape to create a consistency. And I think that's where we're really going to see the most system change happen.
Well, and I do wonder too, what would be, you know, one thing that we could all do better? Because in New Jersey, it's like paper, plastic and glass,
and garbage. Cement shoes.
Hey. What can we all, that hurts, Tim. What can we all do to make it better?
Well, I think if you're traveling, especially as we come into the holidays and you're going from one place to another, check out recyclecheck.org. This is a brand new tool we just launched, and it gets past this idea of, can I recycle this where I am? It connects to the 9,000 different recycling programs that are in this country and allows you to very easily understand, can I recycle this where I am? Now, this is a super duper tool. The public can use it. We're partnering with other other tools and platforms so that people don't have to come for us for the data, but wherever they go to get their data, they can find that, their recycling information. It connects, we use AI technology. We are constantly updating it across the whole country. And I think this is really, really cool. So, you know, your listeners who are thinking about this as they might be commuting home right now, putting your home hat on, it's helpful as you're traveling to visit family to know what's recyclable. But if you also run a business that packages anything that might be waste or trash, this is a really cool tool for you too. Because if you're doing work to green your product, it allows you to have consistent communication so that, you know, when you're there visiting your folks in California and then back in New York.
Things to think about going into the weekend. Keith Harrison, thank you so much of the Recycling Partnership. She is CEO and founder. This is Bluebird.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The key word is survival.
All right, everybody, the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week is out on newsstands online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek on the Bloomberg. In it, a focus on this upcoming week's Bloomberg New Economy Forum, November 8th through 10th in Singapore, annual gathering of world leaders to address the most pressing issues facing the global economy. And so, Tim, in the magazine, there are several stories getting into those issues.
Including from Wall Street to the World Bank, the one risk that towers above all, and then a story about the company most known for making Apple's iPhones and the pivot that it wants to make here in the U.S. So let's get into it. We got the editor of the special New Economy coverage, Bloomberg Businessweek Global Economics editor Christina Lindblad joins us on Zoom in New York City. Also with us is the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Okay, so Joel, want to start with you and just talk about how you think about this issue in the context of the live event that's happening next week.
So we think about it in themes, and there are themes that I think are present in the issue that will also be foundational parts of the conversations that happen in Singapore, where the New Economy Forum will be taking place. I don't get to be there, for the record. I get to be here.
Get to.
So I get to represent with these stories.
You don't have to fly so far.
It's true,
Joel. That's
you know,
the thing.
It was funny. I did email a colleague, and the colleague was like, "Yep, still in flight." And I was like, "Wait a second.
You left yesterday.
You left yesterday." I think, look, like talking about this right now with what's happening in the world, that word risk comes up. We use it on the international cover for the package. The thing that Eric Schatzker, who is one of the colleagues who's there, identified with this is when you talk to a CEO right now or listen to transcripts from all these earning calls or some of the people who have spoken up in the last few weeks and months, geopolitics is the number one concern right now. And it is this massive risk that CEOs feel like they don't really have any control over. It just sort of happens and you're a victim of it. According to Eric's reporting, like that term geopolitics has suddenly surged and become the risk that business leaders around the world are most concerned about. And no doubt that will be one of the biggest themes that come out of these conversations next
week. You guys, Eric mentions in his remarks and comments the Whirlpool CEO who we talked about.
Yeah, Mark Bitzer.
We talked with too, and the concerns there. What's interesting is that in Eric, in his article, his column, he says what makes geopolitical risk so vexing is that it defies modeling, right? So many different things financially we can model out. This we can't. Christina, you oversaw this coverage. It's incredible, the stories. Come on in on the conversation, especially in terms of what Eric wrote and some of the other coverage.
Yeah, I think it's true. It is difficult to model. I mean, everyone has been surprised, I think, in the last couple of years by these cold conflicts that have heated up again. That's been one thing that we've been seeing, but also new kinds of ruptures, you know, with supply chains being reshuffled by the US-China tensions. And that's one thing that we tried to capture. For example, we tried to find countries that were sort of defying this kind of like you're with us or against us kind of rhetoric that you see coming out of the U.S. and to some extent China, and have instead sort of found a way to straddle, you know, these fractures, you know, and become kind of like connectors, new connectors between flows of trade. And that's something that I think in the initial years, the reshuffling of these supply chains is going to be more costly, and IMF and other and central banks have flagged that. But I think over the long term, it will benefit some countries if the flow of trade runs through more nations.
Okay, you're just like talking about it without talking about it. So there's a term that came up in the story, connector economies. And I think, Christina, what really fascinated me about this idea was that the world has been this U.S.-China dichotomy. Like, it's you're either in the U.S. sphere of influence or the China one. But what Inda Curran and Sean Donnan and others helped us illuminate here is that it's much more nuanced than that. So what are these connector economies and who are they?
Well, we chose Poland, Mexico, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Morocco. And Mexico, for example, is a country where this year overtook China as the lead exporter to the U.S. But at the same time, in Mexico, Mexico's imports from China are growing really, really fast, faster than its exports to the U.S., because Chinese companies are setting up shop, Chinese manufacturers are setting up shop along the border primarily to export to the U.S. so they can sidestep Trump's tariffs.
Isn't that
so
amazing?
That's one way you're seeing, like, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I think of it as like, are U.S.-China economies delinking, or are they just linking up in different places?
Yes.
You know?
And look who wins out of that is like a Mexico in that particular equation, right? So I think that's going to be a fascinating dynamic, and I'm really interested to watch these five countries.
Mm-hmm. One story that I wanted to touch on was what's going on with Foxconn. I love this story, Joel.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting
iPhone maker.
Exactly. So it's amazing how much stuff in the world Foxconn actually manufactures. It's like, you know, touch your phone, probably an iPhone made by Foxconn. Not an iPhone, probably made by Foxconn.
It's like crazy.
Look in your living room. If it's a technology device, some sort of tech apparatus, probably made by Foxconn. So we did this story in the issue that really, I think, is a fascinating one by Reed Stevenson. Foxconn, also Taiwanese company, also recognizes that maybe we've reached saturation in what that smartphone market looks like. And their next move, it looks like it might be into electric vehicles. And one of the places that they've acquired is the Lordstown Motors factory in Ohio.
Right.
And they are already overhauling that factory to perhaps become a version of what they do for iPhones, where you basically have a white label manufacturing operation. What if you did the same thing for electric vehicles and, you know, name your manufacturer?
Yeah.
Maybe Foxconn makes that for you.
I don't know. Maybe Apple? I don't know.
I mean... No comment. Read the story. There's a little bit of
the UAW's
reporting
calling again.
And whatnot. And that's also another element of the story. So,
guys, we got to run. But great tease. Check out these stories. Joel Weber, the editor of Business Week. Christina Lindblad, Bloomberg Business Week, global economics editor. Thank you, guys.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast.
Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.